This is an interview for the Shoe Workers Oral History Project at the Museum LA. The date is May 29th, 2009. Today I'm interviewing Dana Pride, and this is Andrea Lumgier. Dana, would you start just by giving me your full name and spelling it?
I am Dana Eugene Pride. D-A-N-A. Eugene, E-U-G-E-N-E. Pride, P-R-I-D-E.
And when and where were you born?
I was born in St. Mary's Hospital, Lewiston, Maine, 1970, July 13th. I don't know what you mean.
That's good. Did you grow up in Lewiston?
I did. Well, Lewiston and then Sabattis, which is the same thing to me.
Right. Just so you spent time in Lewiston?
Yes. Well, I lived here for my first 9 years, and then until I was like 17, I lived in Sabattis, and then I moved back to Lewiston. Lived in Lewiston probably half my life.
Yeah.
But I've had a house for around 10, 12 years in Sabattis. But I still consider, you know, Lewiston and Auburn my town, even because I know where everything is.
Right.
So.
Well, growing up in this area during the 70s and 80s, what was it like in terms of social activities and
my social activities? Well, I lived on High Street in Lewiston, which, if you know now, is all the hospital, Central Maine. In front of us, we had the hospital, and behind us, we had the railroad tracks. So that was our two playing grounds. We played in the security guy just kick us out of the hospital parking lot, and the railroad people used to kick us out of the railroad. So, but there was a whole group of kids that lived on that one side of the street. Right before, when I was like four, they tore down, they used to be both sides of apartments, and they tore down what should be the right-hand side by the hospital down, and they left the left-hand side apartments and houses up. So that's where all my long friends come from. I've known them since, you know, 4 or 5 years old.
Now, I know from talking to you earlier that you had many family members in working in the shoe industry in the area, and I'm wondering if you can, like, go back and talk about
the earliest
sort of chronologically, and then move forward with the different members of your family. What shops they worked in, what did they do?
Shops they worked in. But my father, I'll tell you what it was, my father, my uncle, and my brother. My father's the oldest, so I'll go with him.
And what's his name?
His name is David Pride, Eugene Pride. That's where I got the Eugene from. He cursed me with the same thing. He started, I believe him and my uncle both started at this place called the Belmont, where they had a bunch of, it was, I don't know, a lot of sellers. I don't know exactly how many there was hundreds of them at the time. And they used to sell in 3-pair lots. That's actually, I think, where they both, this would be mid-60s, early 60s that they started down there. And that's where they both, I think, trained to be a hand seller. And my, so they, back in those days, they didn't last very long in one shop. They would go from boom, boom. You know, they didn't like what they were getting paid here. They'd just pick up their jack and their tools, and they would go somewhere else because there used to be many, you know, they call fly-by-nighters, shoe shops. You know, they would get a small run of shoes, and they say, well, they entice them, say, we pay a little better for this over here, and they'd go over here. But then eventually that one would close down, and the big ones would stay around. I think the next one that was big was Quaddy Mock, which was Dave Rancourt was like the foreman over there, who then started the later ones down the line where I started. So my father and my uncle both started at Belmont, and I think they went to different places. I know my uncle worked at Quaddy, and he worked at Downey's Casual, and he worked at Main Shoe and Allen Edmond. I just know him longer because my father got ill later on, and he couldn't hand sew as much anymore. But he did that for like 15 years till he had rheumatoid arthritis and was too tough on his hand, so he couldn't do it for this piecework job. And now my brother, who's 4 years, 3.5 years older than I am, he started at a place called Downey's Casual, which would be about 84. I know his put it there in mind because he was 18 when he started, and he worked at several different places as well. He worked at Bill and Shoe, he worked at Downey's Main Mall, Ellen Edmond, even West Sebago down in Westbrook. My uncle also worked down there too. I basically worked, I didn't leave the town, so I didn't want to go that far. And then it was me. I was 17. And Dave Rancourt knew my uncle pretty well. My uncle was probably one of the top five hand sewers in the state.
And what was his name?
His name was Jeff Pride. And he talked to Dave, and Dave got me into the start sewing. I worked my, I had to lie actually at first, because I say I was 18 years old, and I worked in the making room for like 2 weeks before, you know, they wanted to see what, so they gave me every bad job they could, you know. I remember I was like making $3 and whatever, 15 cents an hour at the time, minimum wage was. So I did that for a couple weeks, and then they started to train me and hand sew. Guy's name who started. Matter of fact, I still got my first shoe, because when they do something, they give you your first shoe. They like to bring it back later on and say, "Hey, what is this?" You know, yeah. That's your first shoe. So.
Yeah. So you worked some of the time. You worked. Your uncle was still working.
Oh yeah, I was at one point. I was actually his boss.
Yeah.
Because I was at Allen Edmond for like a year and a half. I was the foreman of the hand sewing department. He just recently retired, 1.5, 2 years ago, because that's all he did his, you know, his whole life, which is funny with my uncle. This is a funny story I always found funny. In his early years, he started at the Belmont, and you had to make a certain rate, a certain amount of pieces so you'd get paid for it. He did it like for a year and a half, 2 years, and they said, "You're not going to make it, you're not going to make it," because he was more worried about going out to the strip down at the time and drinking beers and doing things like that. And until they, you know, said, "Oh, we're going to fire you because you're not making quota," he didn't really push himself. He didn't care. And then he finally realized he had to push himself a little bit, and then he realized he could actually make pretty good money. It was always a story between my father and my uncle. And my father was just, in the beginning, always made a lot more money than he did. And my father was a good seller, but just, you know, above average. And my uncle, you know, could do almost twice as much as an average seller. So then, you know, in the 70s, he was bringing home $400 a week, which was pretty good money at the time. I mean, my father was selling, we lived on Bates Street at first, then we moved to High Street. His rent was $7 a week, and when it went up to $11, he thought that was outrageous. So, it was pretty good money considered what rent is. So,
yeah.
Well, where was I? I was bambling on again.
Well, talk about the hand sewers as a position in the shoe shops. I mean, they really had a lot of advantages.
The hand sewers were the prima donnas of the hand sewing shop. We got whatever they want. They actually kind of, management kind of resented us a little bit because we had control of what we did. So we got away with a lot more than any more of the other people in the shop. And they catered to us at one time. Because when I came in, it was 87, it was the end of the hand sewing glory years. It was probably like 7 or 8 years of glory years when I came. You could come in when you wanted to. You could leave when you wanted to. If you came in at 9 o'clock in the morning, they didn't say, "Why, are you late? Or what are you doing?" They'd say, "Hey, how you doing?" Then you could leave at 12 o'clock and say, "See you later." And they go, "Oh, come back tomorrow." You know, my brother, when he first started, you know, he just turned 21. He was like 21, so you know, he was going through his consuming of alcohol stage. And Dave Renko, this is always one of my favorite stories, says to him, "We used to work 4 9-hour days and a 4-hour day on Friday. That would give us our 40 hours." He said to him, "Give me 4 good days. Go, give me Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. You can have Friday, Saturday, you know, Sunday off." That didn't work too well. He was living with me at the time, so now I was paying the rent, so he didn't really care. So then he told him, "Give him 3 good days, you know, give him Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and he can take Monday and Friday off." That didn't work out too well either. So then eventually he says, "Give me 20 good hours." At the time, he would just like work 2 days. He could work 2 days, make as much money as the rest of his friends were making working all week long. So, and once again, I was paying his rent. So we we could do what we wanted to. And what would happen was, and they knew, the handsawer was the weakest link in the chain. You could only make as much shoes as the handsawers made. You couldn't make any more than that. So if you didn't cater to them and try to keep them along, then you always took away your maximum production. So they always said they could find someone else to do other things that they could do. But like with hand sewing, 1 out of 10 people who try to hand sew will actually be able to do it. So you just couldn't take, they would take people that had been in the shoe shop 20, 25 years and say, I'm going to train you how to hand sew. And they could do all these other jobs. But then they'd go over there and they couldn't do it. So they had the leverage over them. You know, we used to yell and scream. We'd talk all the time. We had a good old time. Hand sewing is actually fun because if you haven't hand sewed with somebody, you know someone who has. It's, you know, you get the 6 degrees of separation. Well, this is about 1 degree of separation. If they say, blah, 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 guy, you say, well, I don't know him. Someone you know knows that guy because there's not that many. What else did we have? Well, we got paid the most. We probably whined the most, too, but because we considered ourselves special.
Can you talk about sort of the art of hand sewing? I mean, what separated somebody from being able to do it and not being able to do it? And what separated people from being really good at it to being average?
It's a hand sewing shoe is an art, not a science. See? You can say, do this, and do this, and know exactly what you have to do, but it's kind of, it's kind of got to be in you. And I've noticed, too, that families, like mine, and other ones that are in it, too, that have brothers, and they would all seem to catch it for some reason. It was like a genetical, you know, here you go, you know how to sew. And here, and so, that, I couldn't tell you what couldn't make someone do it. I picked it up faster than most people. I was like in a month, I was sewing 24 pairs of shoes, which is what a hand sewer that could have been doing it 15, 20 years could do. Because I was like, I realized that, you know, I was making minimum wage, and if I made more money, I made more shoes, I made more money. So that was my drive. And you're going to realize, too, that a lot of hand sewers used to work through every one of their breaks. They would work like 5 minutes into lunch and 5 minutes past lunch. So that way they were, you'd be self-driven to, you would raise mm-hmm. other people and you would raise yourself. And the key to being a good hand sewer and an average hand sewer was, one, it was drive, but the other thing was to eliminate mistakes. When you hand sew shoes, there's little things you can do. They call them little hitches. You can watch one person and you'll see them moving very quickly, but they're not very, very productive. They do more movements than they have to. If you took someone like my uncle, he looked like he was the slowest guy in there. But there was no wasted movement. The second you would do is an all needles. The second he put his all out, he put his needles in and he'd just pull it out. And then you'd have other people who would double push their needles and then pull twice, and, you know, it's hard to explain, but it was smoothness and eliminating different hitches in the way that you sew without killing yourself. Because it's very, like, I injured myself when I was like 25, 26 years old, my shoulder. Like tendonitis for like a year, where I couldn't move my arm because you think you're constantly pulling. You know, let's say you do 100 stitches on a pair of shoes, which it could be more, and you only do 20. That's like 2,400 times a day pulling with your might to gather and shoot. And then you take, you know, you got baseball pitchers. They limit to them 100 pitches in a game every 5 days, and now you're doing it 5 days a week, 10,000 times, and it's one of them. Because a lot of hand sewers would, I think almost every hand sewer had tendonitis or carpal tunnel ones. I used to wake up, and like for the first hour, I couldn't feel my hands. You could, until you shoved one of the needles under your things, and then you'd wake up. But I couldn't tell you why some people, I think drive is a big one. You got to be able to push yourself. Always race yourself all the time. It's not like if you get paid by the hour where you're just, you know, the clock is your enemy because it goes by so slow. When you're sewing shoes, you look at the clock and say, oh, it went by that fast. You're always trying. Almost every hand sewer I know, I don't think there is one, always has a clock right there that they have to look at because they're always timing themselves and they're always trying to pick up time within what they're doing. Without, you know, of course, you got to make the shoe good too. Because there's some people who they call butchers who just didn't matter what they would do. They would just punch 18 million holes in them and just try to slap it. But eventually, you know, the company would get rid of them because they were making not very good shoes. That's all I know. I couldn't tell you why. What makes one good and not good. I would say drive and
now, racing. Did your family members teach you? Did you pick things up before you actually went into the shop to train?
Not really. I mean, there was always, you would go to my father's house, they always talk shop all the time. The biggest thing is, have you punched your clock yet? Because you'd come home and say, oh yeah, these shoes over here, they was like tight or big, or, you know, there was different overcasts on them. So it was always being in discussion all the time. One of the, my uncle's son, which is my cousin, he was the only one that never hand sewed, and he always hated that, but his father never wanted to, him to get into hand sewing, because it was like one of those things, once you got in, it was hard to get out of it. And he could, you know, he could see the, he's younger than me, he could see the, it's slowly demising. That's what they slowly did, the hand sewing, is when the shops went away, and they couldn't now go over to different hand sewing shops, and there was more hand sewers than there was shops. That's when they started, you know, they said, oh, you had the upper hand over us, now we have it over you. They used to say, like, where are you going to go if you don't come here? And they would, it started from when you could leave when you want to, like, right now, they want you to punch in 6 minutes before or to 6 minutes later after the thing, you know, it's not like right. It was. I mean, the foreman used to go over to the bar to get the people, come on back, it's all your shoes, because there'd be 7-8 people over there, you know, the Ritz Cafe or wherever it was, you know.
Right.
Come on back and sew some shoes. Now, if they get caught drinking a beer, like on Thursday, just one beer, they get in trouble. So. But no one really shows, it's one of those things that, they show you little hints as you're doing it, because it's hard to explain. Where they say, they'll watch you do something, they say, well, you shouldn't do that. And it's better to train them earlier, because once you catch, you start a hitch, it's hard to break yourself of it because you're so used to doing that. Because mm-hmm. I went in the service for like 3 years, and I came back and I started hand sewing again. And what, I broke all the things that 3 years off made me, when I come back, you had to kind of like relearn. You knew how to do it. It was like a bike, but you could then relearn it so you didn't have that hitch that you were trying to, because I couldn't do it while I was sewing, because I would always catch myself like double tapping tacks or pushing two needles in a time. There was little things that, well, I watched them. When I was young, I got moved right behind my uncle. We had different benches that went along. And he'd be flapping his gums, smoking cigarettes, talking to these other people. I'd be going as fast as I can, sweat pouring off of me, and he'd still beat me every time. And it looked like he was going so slow. But he would just say, oh, all you gotta do is this, you take this, and, you know, there's different ways everybody sets up shoes and does things. They showed me little things, but it's got to be in you, you know?
When did you start to see the industry getting a lot smaller? I mean, you left eventually. Was it because the shop you worked at closed and you were laid off?
The one that mine's probably a little bit different than most. But it's still open right now, but there's only a couple sewers still left in it. That's Alan Edmonds. Is that at one point there I was the boss of it. And I could see as middle management that the upper management, because it became more corporate, they were always squeezing, trying to get, they would add more things on to people to do without any more money on piecework. So people were still making the same amount of money now as they did 15 years ago, because they never really got a raise. And then it got very frustrating to me, because they would add new styles with more elaborate stitching to it or whatever it is, and they would try to, I mean, the rule used to be, used to get 10 cents for every overcast. Well, that was 30 years ago. And then 30 years later, they would still want to give you 10 cents for this overcast, and the plugs used to be, which is the top of the shoe, used to be a lot shorter, and they made the plugs a lot longer, so you had to do more work into it. And they realized, and I think a lot of it had to do, I think, the prima donna days of them and their resentfulness, and that we had that little bit of power, and when the shoe turned on the other foot, that kind of came back on, and they kept saying, oh, where are you going to go? You've been doing this, like, you know, my uncle and all this, you know, 25. A lot of these people who are in there doing it 30 years, that's the only thing they know how to do. And they made a good living for most of their life doing that. Mm-hmm. So they said, what are you going to do? What are you? And so when I left, because after I got off being foreman, I said, I'm just going to go back to the bench and sell my shoes. But I knew information on them now because I knew I went to all their meetings and I saw all these things. And then, as you can tell by this interview, that I'll talk. So eventually, they laid me off. That's what they called it, laid me off. Which was the best thing that happened to me because I then got TRA. I got the whole Allen Edmonds TRA, which means if you got laid off because they were starting to send things to the Dominican, that you could go to school for 2 years. So that's how, and now I work in a laboratory in a hospital. But that's how I got that from there, is because I got laid off. See, work started slowing down. They were sending work to the Dominican Republic. Mm-hmm. I mean, I actually got calls before when I was, that they wanted me to go to, somebody wanted me to go to Pakistan to teach in Lahore people how to sew shoes, because they give them, you know, 50 cents or 25 cents to sew these shoes, but they're giving $5 to $7 a pair for these hands. So it's all, the shoe industry is just slowly declining. I bet you they have probably 25 sewers left that are still doing it. Mm-hmm. Considering there was, at one point I heard there was like 5,000 sewers that were in this region. This used to be the, you know, hand sewing capital of the best sewers are still in Maine.
Are they?
Yeah. Always have been. They had other ones in Massachusetts and Minnesota, but Maine was always the, when I see anyway, Maine was always the best. Maybe I'm a little bit biased, but I'm sticking to it.
Did the hand sewers or shoe workers in general, did they socialize together a lot?
Oh, yeah. You knew almost everybody in there. It was usually at the bar. They had little dive bars that were all around those little mills, and you knew all the people in there. Mm-hmm. I mean, we used to play jokes on each other, and that was the fun of it, you know. One of my favorite jokes used to be when the new guy come in, and it'd be Christmas time, I'd tell him, you know, hey, did you sign up for your turkey yet? Like a Thanksgiving. And you go in there, they go in the office, and they ask, oh, I'm here to sign up for my turkey, you know. And or ham, we say turkey, and hit Christmas time, it was ham. Of course, the people in the office would be going, huh? What are you talking about? But what was good about it is when they'd come out, they wouldn't come out and go, they would play along so we could send the next guy. And they go, yeah, I just signed up for my turkey. And then they would go over there, and, you know, it was all, most hand sewers would just sit there and talk to each other across the room or across the aisle, and they would just, you know, they'd have different functions. That was like your family away from family. I mean, mm-hmm. Most of the time when you're working, that's more than half your life anyway, that these people are. Like I said, if you don't know this one person, someone else knows that person. And somewhere down the line, a lot of them used to drink. Used to be a key thing to shoe work. But even the making room and it wasn't as much, but you knew all the people in there. If they worked over there like 2 or 3, 4 years in the, you would know, like, you got a kind of like all the P shards, and there's like 8 million of those who work in the shoe shops where I was working anyway. And you know most of the, especially by face, you'd say, oh, I know that person, I know that person. You might not know everyone's name, but you probably know 80% of the people's names in a plant that had, what, when down east it had like 150, 200, I don't know how many people in there. It's hard to recall. At that one particular plant. So they would know each other, and they would have Christmas parties, and they would go to a bar.
Did the shoe shop sponsor any sort of social activities at all? Like, you know, like, team sports or anything like that?
Not really. Not that I can think of. It would have to be someone inside would have to do it. You know, they
right.
would say, I'd start this sport and then, you know, softball, whatever.
Right.
They,
so
they would basically, you know, wanted to make the shoes. I don't think they were looking at as in a way, they didn't like us all. They like to keep you separated and mm-hmm. not together, because then you can rebel against them. And that's what they want to do. They want to isolate you. That's what they used to do to a lot of soldiers at Kenon. They call them the renegades. The people who would go from here to here, if they were troublemakers of some sort. And then they'd like kick them out. But then they would still need their production, so they would subcontract off to these other little shops that do the same shoes. And these renegades would then sew from there, because they could still sew shoes. They just didn't want them. And now earlier, in the they didn't care. You know, there was people that, you know, there was fist fights and people out in the parking lot drinking, smoking, you know, doing all kinds of stuff. And, you know, it turned to, I didn't look at that. But as it got more, there was more sewers and less, they got more, you know, we're going to get rid of this troublemaker. Right. So I think they tried to isolate everybody. There, one thing as the later came on says, where are you going to go? If you leave here, where are you going to go? If you've been doing this for 30 years, where are you going to go if we let you go? And that was kind of how they kept, they really didn't want them to go, because they knew they couldn't get anybody to do what they do, you know, with their experience, but they would use that pressure on them all the time. At least that was my thing.
Did you ever hear any stories that maybe your dad and uncle told about their early days in the shoe shops before you started?
Stories? Like what? They have all kinds of stories. Like I said, they were... That's what they call a dramatic pause. But most of them had to do with, you know, them fighting each other, and you know, but it was always friendly. You know, the next day, because I can't remember anything in specifically, except like my uncle not making it, and different people, how they went to different shops. And we used to, I remember one time, we had these shoes, and they were all tight, which means they didn't fit very well on their last, and everybody in the room was getting, there was like 45, 50 of us at the time, and this was at either Cohan or Down East, they bought it. So everybody, and we were right outside the office of the, you know, president, whatever they wanted to call themselves at the time, and everybody just started slamming their hammers on the benches, going, oh, and everybody comes running out of the office and looking at us, because we were all angry that they weren't doing anything about this thing. So they were like, why are you guys making all this noise? Of course, you know what? They fixed that after that. Because that was like one of the... And the hand sewers used to, I swear, they would be 40 feet away and have a conversation all day long, yelling. Hmm. Back and forth, you know, three or four rows over, you know. And they would constantly ribbing people back and forth, you know, like your mama jokes and things like that. Oh, yeah. That's why a lot of times, you know, you would get over the... And then there'd be, you know, hey, I'll take you outside type of thing. Right. But as it got older and the hand sewers got older, you know, they calmed down a little bit. They weren't as young and as brash as they. I mean, I was always the youngest hand sewer wherever I was. Even though I've been doing it for 15 years, I was still the youngest hand sewer, you know? I was like, because they really didn't train anybody after me. They did, but none of them ever made it, because they changed their training style of it. They used to be, you know, it's like the pool. Here's the pool, I'm throwing you in the water, see if you swim. And then they changed it over when the corporates came over, and they said, okay, I'm going to take someone who's doing this job. I'm going to give you a raise to train you to be a hand sewer. And well, the problem was they were feeling happy that they just got a raise to be a hand sewer. But the problem was that drive and determination thing that like forced me, and I said, I'm getting minimum wage, and I need to make more and more to go faster. Well, that didn't happen, and all these people kept failing and failing and failing, because as they were learning too, because they had no drive to go faster, is they got all these little hitches in your thing too, because they weren't going like you're supposed to go. You know, they were trying to make it really slow instead of making it one fluid motion and out through. So then they would fail. I was always the last one, which is weird. But I don't, can't think of any stories with they specifically. I probably have like 100 that they did, but I can't think of any. Most of it became with fighting and drinking.
Yeah.
And just general arguments.
Any such thing as a female hand sewer?
Oh, yeah, there's all kinds of. Usually, when there was a female hand sewer, it was a husband and wife. There's been plenty of them. There are some that just been regular female hand sewers, but most of the female hand sewers had a, was a husband and wife thing. The husband would learn it and teach it to the wife usually, and then they would go along. I mean, there was some good female hand sewers. They had the Braileys, they had Lorraine. Lorraine was like 4 feet tall. You probably I don't know her last name is Lorraine. And the strings were like 6 feet long, so she'd pull once and then pull twice, and you know, she had to just to get it in there because she was so short. But she could actually do pretty good. And a lot of the males would last for the females because lasting was more strenuous on your, you needed more upper body strength to pull the shoes up. So a lot of the times, the male would last the shoe and she would just sew. But there was some who was, I can think of 3 or 4 women that I knew along the way who did both of them. I would say women were probably, you know, 1 out of 10 sewers was a woman, mm-hmm. roughly.
Well, that's more than I thought. I haven't talked to any female hand sewers yet.
So oh, yeah.
I'll have to find one.
Oh, yeah. There is, I'd say, 1 out of 10. That's about right. Mm-hmm. It probably wasn't way back in the, it was probably more male-orientated, but as when I got in there, it was usually husband and wives, and then sometimes they would divorce, and then there would only be one wife. So,
right.
So then they'd have to do it themselves. So, but I know like 1, 2, 3, 4, 10, 15. I don't know.
Yeah,
there's more than you would think, and most of them were, you know, did pretty good at it. But it's like that family thing again, where they had the other person to support them as they learn. So, I don't know if that's genetic.
You talked about your uncle being one of the exceptional hand sewers around. Mm-hmm. Were there others that you recall that were just shined?
Vern Daigle. He was. He had my uncle. Vern was probably the fastest one. There was other. I can't think of. A lot of those ones that were there before me, but they always talked about them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was like in the top 10% in sewing. I could sew just as fast as about anybody. My problem was that I couldn't do it every day. I had to take a break. That's how it was. But listen, but I know all kinds of sewers. But we're talking about, you have fast sewers, and then you have like good sewers who like sew everything and they look like they're samples on every time. See? And then you got people that can do it fast and good. Like, that's like my Vern and my uncle. But there are some people who just sewed sample shoes all the time. When you're sewing sample shoes all the time, you can't really go fast because you want to make everything look perfect. Oh, I'm trying to think of some names.
Did you know Dick Cordemarsh?
Dick Cordemarsh. Oh, but I bet you I know someone who does.
You do too.
Where did he sell? Do you know?
Don't recall.
I know Dick Cordemarsh. There's a lot of Frenchmen in the hand sellers. I don't know if you know that. And I'm a non-Frenchman. Which made me a minority in the shoe shop.
Well, now Pride, where does your family come from originally?
Well, it's an English name. We came over in 1620 in Salem, Massachusetts. Someone named John Pride. One of my, well, this doesn't have anything to do with that, but I always think it's interesting that one of my relatives was accused of being a witch.
Mm.
And she actually sued him for defamation of character and got like 6 goats and a cow from him. So,
that's wild.
Yeah, and then they moved up here. Like the Pride. Pride in Westbrook, you got Pride's Corner
mm-hmm.
in the first bridge. Those are my relatives. I never saw any of that money. We must have been like the black sheep that spread off down there and ended up in Lewiston or something.
Did you know your grandparents? Did they live in Lewiston too, or was it?
My grandparents, let's see. My grandparents on my mother's side lived in Sebattis, which is basically Lewiston, but it's not.
Right.
On my father's side, I didn't know my father's mother. She died of emphysema before I was born. Right before I was born, she died. And my grandfather, he was in the Army a lot. And they had like 7 kids who used to live in Green. And they were, as they determined it, was very poor. They used to travel up and down the sides of the roads collecting bottles and cans. And they'd walk miles and miles and miles. But so he moved around. He wasn't a shoe worker. So I don't know where they got theirs from. He wasn't, and I don't know what her grandmother, my grandfather on my mother's side, he worked in Bates Mill, the one over there, for like 50 years. That was, making, I see, I got some old pictures, you know, where they're in front of the machines there, you know.
Balloons?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he was over at the one, what's the one that they, right by the trestle? Libby Mill, I think it is. I think that's the one.
Yeah.
I think he worked there for. He didn't work when I knew him because he was like born in 1893. So.
Oh wow.
Yeah, my mother was a, later in life, excuse me, kind of baby.
Yeah.
You know.
So, yeah. So he was almost 80 when you were born.
Well, he died in 79. So that was 80 something. You could catch some good fish, though. And he always had butterscotch candy.
Oh,
I like
that's important. Is there anything that I haven't asked you about shoe working that you think is important to add?
Mm-hmm.
If it's about, you know.
What are you looking for? In what kind of way? Are you looking for the mindset? Most hand sewers are crazy, too.
Are they?
Yes. You have to kind of be either that, or you have good headphones to block out, because there's a lot of chatter that goes on all throughout the day of constant, ribbing each other and doing things. And so I would say, for the most part, hand sewers are unique in that they're kind of
very social, it sounds like.
They're social. Well, some are not. You have some people who just go in there and they're going to sew their shoes and go along their merry way, and they're not going to talk at all. But I'd say that's 20%. But they have to be able to deal with the 80% that's just plain lunatics. Cool. We used to, grease up their tools when they go out to there, so when they come back, or they'd have a shoe done halfway, you'd cut their threads off, so when they pull them, they would pull out of the shoe, and you were constantly trying to one-up each other in things you do, It was, and then you could ride them all day long if they did something, So it was friendship, but it was also, it was part of the, that's what I thought was very funny. It wasn't like, you go to work and you just sit there in the press. When you're hand sewing, there's no machines around. So there's no real noise. You're in an open room. Where they just line you all up, and the only real noise is if someone's like banging on their hammer, but that's not very, so it's quiet where you can hear someone 40 feet away if you're just talking like I am to you right now. So you would have, rivals and things, and they were very crazy. I don't know how to know the word crazy, but they were. I was crazy too, so, we'd sing and we'd have everybody in there singing songs. You have like 50 people singing a song at the same time, just for fun, just to see if we could get a rise out of someone else.
Right.
That was always the thing, it was always good ribbon. I mean, I remember my uncle, this is back when you could smoke inside the shop, he had a big pile of ashes that was, 5 inches high, that he'd take a puff of a cigarette and put it up there, and he'd just be talking away to the guy way over there about what they did for fishing or what they did for this, and it was like constant. And no one, and that was the norm. That wasn't the abnormal. So now I forget what you asked. something that I should tell. Hands-on is, I still miss it today. I liked hands-on because each shoe was like different. It was like, you know, you had to figure out how you were going to do this. It wasn't, you know, okay, cookie cutter, boom, boom, boom. You could take 20 sewers and you took 20 pairs of shoes and you put them up there. That sewer could go up there and pick his pair of shoes out because they all have something just a little bit different. You could know, even though if you took a normal personal, then they would say, oh, they all look the same. But the hand sewer could go over to that shoe and go, that one's mine. That one's mine. More than, with probably a 90, 95% likelihood that he could just say, oh, that's mine right there. Because you can just tell by the way you sew the shoe. You know, and you have people that were, like I always say, with Dave Rancor, when he first had it, he could walk by your rack and you this was 12 pair lots of time. You know, you'd have a shoe that wasn't very good leather, whatever it is, and it would wrinkle, it didn't look very good, and you'd like try to hide it over there. And he'd come right by and he could just pick it right up. Hey, well, what's this? Yeah. What? You used to call it like this, you know? He'd go, hey, oh, yeah, okay, Dave. You know? I mean, he, like I said before, he bailed my uncle out of jail before because he needed some shoes done. You know? I need to get this done. All right. You know, he did a little drunken disorderly down on Lisbon Street. Nothing bad. Bailed him out so he could come sell some shoes for him. You know? That's the key.
Yeah. Well, great. Thank you so much, Dana.
You're welcome, Andrea.